Labour's been setting out the key priorities for its spending review before the full details are announced on Wednesday. £86 billion will be spent on the science and technology sectors, and there'll be more money for the NHS and schools. Speaking on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, the Technology Secretary Peter Kyle declined to rule out real-term spending cuts to police and other areas, warning that every part of our society is struggling. The deputy leader of Reform UK, Richard Tice, says the party knows what it's doing, despite the upheaval of the past 2 days. Reform's chairman, Zia Yusuf, resigned on Thursday after a row with an MP who'd proposed banning the burqa, only to return to the party yesterday. Mr. Tice said Mr. Yusuf had been under too much pressure. Prince William's been addressing world leaders in Monaco, calling for urgent action to protect the world's oceans. A UN conference on the issue will get underway tomorrow. The Prince of Wales told the Blue Economy and Finance Forum healthy oceans were essential to all life on Earth.
This challenge is like none that we have faced before. But I remain an optimist. I believe that urgency and optimism have the power to bring about the action needed to change the course of history. Watching human activity reduce beautiful sea forests to barren deserts at the base of our oceans is simply heartbreaking.
The governor of California has described President Trump's order to deploy 2,000 National Guards to counter protests in Los Angeles as inflammatory. Gavin Newsom accused Mr. Trump of trying to create a spectacle. The confrontation between residents of a predominantly Hispanic district and the security forces began 2 days ago when immigration officers detained unauthorized migrants. A Colombian presidential candidate, Miguel Uribe, is in a critical condition after he was shot 3 times during a campaign event in the capital, Bogotá. The city's mayor said the senator had undergone surgery and was in the first critical hours of recovery. Wildlife experts in the Indian state of Kerala are trying to rescue a tiger that's fallen into a 4.5-metre deep hole with a dog. Villagers suspect the tiger chased the dog, causing both to accidentally fall in. And the weather, breezy day with a mixture of sunny spells and scattered showers, these turning locally heavy and thundery across central England. BBC News, it's 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Hilary Cotton is a writer, innovator, and social entrepreneur who wants to find solutions for some of the most intractable problems of our time, from the design of prisons to how we provide care for the elderly and might end long-term unemployment. In her book, Radical Help, she argued that we need to reinvent the welfare state to meet the challenges of the 21st century. And in her most recent book, The Work We Need, she focuses on how we could reimagine work in a way that benefits everyone in a world facing immense technological change and ecological crisis. Well, you've brought to help us to that end some lovely music, Hilary. Pergolesi, Chopin, Schubert. But I think we're going to start with Erik Satie.
Yes, this is what we call Sunday music in our house. I travel a lot for my work. I'm often living and staying in quite difficult places. And so this is just a sort of homecoming, kind of setting a different feeling for a Sunday morning.
Thank you.
It's such a pleasure, actually, to listen without the bustle of a normal Sunday. It's
Lent, yes. Slow, from Eric Satie's Nocturne, performed by Aldo Ciccolini. I get very much the feeling that you are quite immersed in music and may have been for a long time. Tell me a little bit about your parents.
Both my parents are very musical. My mother is an excellent singer, and my father was an organist who actually won a scholarship to the Royal College of Music, but his parents wouldn't let him go. They felt that it wasn't a sort of appropriate career for somebody of his standing, and he had to go and train to be a chartered accountant, and he had a very interesting career. But when I was a child, he had an organ. We lived in a very small, modest house in Madrid, and he had this organ. I would go to sleep at night listening to the whole house. The walls would shake and the windows would shake, and it was just such an exciting sound, and I've really loved organ music ever since. We used to love it when, is it the Bach piece that is just with the pedals? And we always kind of requested that one, but he had a kind of very broad love of music. And played
Spain, how do you come to be there then?
Yeah, so my parents met because my father played the organ and my mother sang in the church choir, and they met in East Africa and they travelled around the world. And I think partly because my father had this work as an accountant, he was always travelling and exploring, and he just chose that as a place to move to, and it's where we grew up.
And that's where you were born?
No, I was born actually in between Peru and London, and then we moved when I was very, very small to Madrid, yes.
And what are your memories of being there? Do you speak Spanish?
I do speak Spanish, and I've worked a lot in Latin America. I'm very grateful that I speak Spanish. I remember just quite a sort of happy childhood, really. I think the other really important thing about my father was that because he made this choice and he became an accountant, not that he was bitter about it in any way, but he had this very strong sense that his children should follow their own heart's path, really. And he always really encouraged us to do that. And I think it's sometimes quite hard to describe what I do, but it was definitely a path with heart.
And were there other children, siblings?
Yes, I've got a younger sister. Mm. She's a GP.
So music was clearly in the household.
There was only classical music in our house. I remember we had a sort of reel-to-reel tape machine, and the one thing on it that wasn't classical was that popcorn music. And so, in a way, I then had to kind of find my own love, I think, of it, because we did live a life immersed in classical music.
Well, I think this next piece is very much a reminder of your father, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because he was an organ player and very good piano player. But I've chosen in this recording of Frank by Naji Hakim, who I also heard play in Southwark Cathedral, which is somewhere that I've had a very long relationship with myself.
Thank you.
Steve McQueen asks people to turn the volume up really loud for his films. I feel it's a bit the same with that everyone needs to turn the volume up and feel the vibration through the body, really.
You like that feeling in a cathedral where you can feel the walls shaking?
I absolutely do. To be so kind of immersed in that bath of organ music is just so beautiful. I suppose partly because, as I say, our whole home used to shake when I was a child.
We heard the chorale No. 3 in A minor by César Franck, performed by Naji Hakim. Hilary Cottam, your parents sent you to boarding school back in the UK. Was that a culture shock for you?
It wasn't a culture shock, because that time, growing up in Madrid, there were a lot of English people and all English children went to boarding school. So, you know, we read Mallory Towers and we kind of expected to go without thinking about it. It's only later in life, I mean, I was 10 years old and my sister was 9, and it's later in life maybe that I've reflected on the very strangeness of that sort of education, really.
Did you learn a musical instrument?
Yes, so it was a very musical school, and I learned the piano, and we had piano practice built into the curriculum, into the school day, and we had rows and rows of piano practice rooms. And I was a terrible student. I didn't enjoy it. I had a very strict teacher and I really hated it. And I always tried to get a practice room on the back where you could basically jump out into the woods and have a cigarette and a gossip with your friends. And it's terrible, really, because, you know, sort of to have that privilege. Later I came back and I play the piano now, not well, but as an adult I then found a piano teacher. But I didn't really like it. And every Sunday we used to go to these festival halls concerts, and we used to be kind of wearing these itchy grey suits and trussed up, and I used to watch all the other kids in the undercroft kind of skateboarding, and I just wanted to be outside.
What did you decide to study at university?
History, modern history, 0 to 1965 at Oxford.
And the Pergolesi Stabat Mater that we're going to hear next, that comes from that time?
That time. So I think, you know, arriving at Oxford, it was wonderful to kind of break out of school, really, and kind of experiment and learn all sorts of things. I heard music, you know, like Philip Glass's Flow, that really made me rethink what classical music could be. And this piece of music reminds me of sitting, you know, right in the roof of the Sheldonian Theatre and just being sort of tucked up there and listening to this beautiful sound. And I never got over the privilege and the luckiness of living in that extraordinary city.
Thank you. We heard the opening of the Pergolesi Stabat Mater Dolorosa, performed by the soprano Julia Faulkner and the mezzo-soprano Anna Gonda, with the Budapest Camerata Orchestra, conducted by Michael Halash. Hilary, what was your path into the world of work?
So I wanted, in a sort of very naive way, really, to change the world, I suppose. And I was very much drawn, it was sort of, you know, Thatcher's Britain. Things felt very close to me here in terms of what could change. So I looked at other parts of the world, and of course I had no experience and nobody wanted me, and I just wrote hundreds of letters. And I ended up working for the humanitarian wing of a guerrilla army in northern Ethiopia in Tigray. So that was my first experience, which was actually the most incredible experience. I mean, I was put there because in the Cold War, they needed somebody who could write applications for them to fund different kinds of work they were doing. But they were building underground hospitals, roads, different forms of kind of very grassroots community projects. And it was just a very extraordinary learning experience for me, really.
So, in fact, rather than dreaming of becoming a rock star and changing the world, you wanted to get down to the grassroots.
I really did. For whatever reason, I was always convinced, I think, that if one could understand the world from that perspective, that the answers would be there.
You went to live in the Dominican Republic.
Yes. I went, first of all, to live in the Dominican Republic as a field representative with an international NGO and spent sort of, I think, 5 years there. I went to the World Bank and then I returned to the Dominican Republic to do the research for my PhD. And I went to live in a barrio of about 40,000 people who lived in a network of open sewers. So it's under the main suspension bridges of the city.
And I think barrio is a neighbourhood, isn't
it? Yeah, barrio is a term for a poor neighbourhood. It's a, you know, an informal neighbourhood, if you like. So houses built of tin and wood. It was under the main suspension bridges of the city, so all the city can look down on it, and there's lots of mythologies about those places. And again, I wanted to kind of understand what was really happening there.
One of the things you wanted to understand was why the children weren't going to school.
Well, that's right. So at the top on the metalled road was this fantastic Jesuit school. And the children in the barrio didn't go to this school. It was free for public education. And I was really intrigued because when I worked for the NGO, I'd worked with the Ministry for Education, Department of Health. And one of the things we'd been looking at together was, why do primary school children not attend? And so we'd run focus groups with populations in urban and rural areas. And we'd been told that school meals would be really important because people have to walk to school and they're hungry, and that school uniforms were prohibitively expensive. So coming out of these focus groups, we designed programmes for free school meals and free school uniforms. But in the barrio, when I said, why are your children not in school? We were like, oh, the thing is, our children don't have identity cards. You can't access public education without an identity card. And the reason people don't have identity cards is very complicated, shameful, like most welfare issues are. For example, many of the children are illegitimate and people don't want to go and declare that in front of a sort of more educated, lighter skinned magistrate. And I think this was so important to me because the things that will enable social programmes, welfare programmes, work programmes, whatever they are, to work, are these insights. And I realised in that moment that I had to work in a completely different way, that however much you want to help in an NGO, in a Ministry of Education, people speak certain things to power that they think weren't heard. And I needed to kind of develop a way of working, a methodology. I had to unlearn, if you like, and learn again. And that started there in the barrio. So it was a really formative experience.
And I think we've got music now that rather reminds you of your time living there. Bachata?
Bachata, yes. Well, I mean, the Dominican Republic is, I loved living there. It's a country with so much art and music. And what we're going to hear is a song called Acompáñame Civil by Juan Luis Guerra, who's one of the most famous Dominican musicians, a brilliant musician.
He sold 15 million records and he's very influential.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that before Juan Luis Guerra, nobody heard of Dominican music outside the Dominican Republic. And this comes from an album of the bachata rhythm. And the bachata rhythm is the rhythm of the barrio. When I lived in the barrio in the 90s, middle class people didn't really want to be seen dancing bachata because it. But now, I mean, he has popularized it and everybody dances it. And so I've chosen this because it reminds me of the barrio, it reminds me of the Dominican Republic, and also because there's a lot of humour there. And this is just a story of, you know, being pulled over by the police because you're the wrong person and having to kind of bribe your way back out of it.
Bajaba la tira de en mi carro. De pronto un faro intermitente me hizo señas de parar. Mi licencia de conducir me pidió con ojo febril que se le va a hacer.
Well, it makes me laugh and it also makes me want to dance. A lot of that album actually is very, very romantic, but that's definitely sort of something of the street and for dancing to. And then that sound, you know, the guida, the grater with her, which is so typical of Hispanic Caribbean.
Yeah, yes. The instruments like a guero, which are...
That's right.
Where you actually have eked out vegetables and fruit.
Yes.
And you run a piece of metal along the side of it.
That's right. And sometimes it's metal against metal, actually, in the room. I think often it looks like it is the family cheese grater that's kind of, you know, making the sound, but with incredible rhythm.
Accompagnement Civil, composed by Juan Luis Guerra and performed by his ensemble. You returned Hilary Cottam to the UK in 1998 and set up two award-winning social enterprises. One was called Schoolworks, looking at redesigning schools. Why was that important?
Well, I came back to Britain sort of just after the Labour government had got into power in 97 and were investing in a big way in social systems. And one of the programmes was to basically rebuild 1950s secondary schools. And so working with Estelle Morris, who was then the Secretary of State for Education, we were able to do a £14 million project to take one school in South London.
Was that Kingsdale School?
It was Kingsdale School, yes, which at that time was, in inverted commas, failing. See how we could, with the help of architects, the community, redesign the school, the curriculum and its interaction with the neighbourhood. And it's still, I'm proud to say, one of the most successful schools in South London. But we went on to do 42 more schools and leading to a programme called Building Schools of the Future, where it was no longer possible to sort of do just a kind of school infrastructure project without thinking about the families, the teachers, the curriculum and how those should all work together.
Well, after that, you turned your mind to prisons with the not-for-profit called Dutank. You put learning at the heart of your ideas. This went very much against accepted thinking at the time, didn't it?
Well, that's right. You know, the first thing we had to do was design a cell that left room for learning, and nobody wanted that because they're like, oh, you can't have the bed against the wall. And we're like, well, it's the 20th century. If you can't design me a wall that people can't dig their way out or with a plastic spoon. So it was about, you know, in a way, prisons do have a curriculum. They have a curriculum about how to be a better criminal. And we know that 80% of people who go to prison are young. They can't read or write effectively to get good work. And so why could we not turn that curriculum on its head? So this was a proposal basically to redesign prisons to get money out of an estate that is not fit for purpose and use it for a learning curriculum within the prison designed with prisoners. And their imagination as well about what would actually work for them was very, very rich, and using programmes from other countries that have been proven to be very successful.
Scandinavia is very good at this.
Scandinavia, yes. I worked very closely with the Dutch prison system, the Norwegian prison system, the Canadian prison system. We all went to the House of Commons to try to persuade the British system, and we failed. I think it's my only project, actually, ever that has not been properly realised, although I will say that I met my husband, who was working with youth offenders at that point, so I guess it had a happy ending in one way.
You were awarded UK Designer of the Year in 2005. What was that for, and how did that feel?
I was awarded for three sets of work: the school work, the prisons work, and some work I did in health. So the work of all the designers was exhibited at the Design Museum. A winner was chosen by a jury and a public vote, and it was a very uncomfortable experience. I'm not a designer in the sense that I didn't go to art school and I haven't formally trained as a designer, although I work with these visual methods that enable different stories and different imaginations to come through. And many people, older people in particular in the design field, had very strong feelings that, you know, Hillary Cottam could be a designer when she wasn't formally a designer. I can't use the language of the kind of hate mail I got on this programme, but people were very vociferous about it. But the upshot, in a way, was fantastic. First of all, I won a prize. I won £25,000 and I used that to start my next venture called Participle, which has done all the welfare work, which I'm very proud of. And then the other thing is that now that story seems so anachronistic because the whole field of social design has opened up. There are courses in universities all around the world, and young people who train in design in particular are passionate about this work, about how to use design skills to change the world, basically. So it's very exciting what's happened since.
A fantasy for piano using four hands next, and I wonder if one of them has been yours.
Well, just before my father died, we were learning a Dvorak piano duet together, and I think it was more laughter on my part than good piano practice. But I really love this Schubert piano piece. It's beautiful music, and I particularly love the way that Murray Pariah and Radu Lupu play together. I think their teamwork is just exceptional in this recording. I do think that is sublime music, actually. And when I was waiting for my daughter to be born, we were told there were going to be many complications, which actually there weren't. But it was quite a sort of nervous moment, I suppose. We used to play that music particularly then, but it's just a beautiful piece of music.
Yes, I played that with my father, and my brother played it with him. And there is something about throwing subtle interpretations of a phrase out into the open to see if it's picked up and
yes.
sent back.
Yes.
Which brings a family together in a way, brings people together.
Yes, you can hear that, can't you? The themes coming out and coming back, like a tide, really, I suppose.
I think you could probably manage that.
Okay, well, I've got something to practice, that's excellent.
We heard the Fantasy for Piano Four Hands in F minor by Franz Schubert, played wonderfully by Murray Pariah and Radu Lupu. Hilary Cottam, in 2006 you started Participle to try and come up with prototypes for an alternative welfare state for this century. Why at that particular time was this so needed?
I suppose because I had been working in existing organisations for quite some time, and what I really felt was that a lot of energy was going into improving systems that really weren't designed for this century, and that so a lot of work was going into incremental, what you might call acupuncture. Now, acupuncture, I love acupuncture, it's not that it's not useful, but what would be the systems that we actually need to support us in this different century when we're different people, we live in such different ways?
Because the original idea was put forward by William Beveridge. What was at the heart of his ideas?
Yes, so Beveridge produced the blueprint for the British welfare state. And his idea really was that everybody in this country should flourish, coming out of the divisions of the Second World War and all the difficulties that preceded that. Every person, no matter where they were born or who they were, should be given the support that they needed. You know, good healthcare, support if they become disabled through work, pensions. And so then he thought about a whole sort of infrastructure, if you like, that would support people to live well. But I think what's also really important for my work now is that Beveridge, he was a labour economist, and he thought that the problems in society came through a shift in work from kind of old agricultural technology, if you like, to the carbon-based industrial technology. And, you know, there were all these stories at the time that the problems were immigration, too many people were coming from the villages, the problems were kind of lazy workers, all these things that we hear today. And he said, no, this is a problem of transition, that when societies move from one way of being to another, they're not going to do it unless we think really deeply about how we support people. So I wrote a manifesto called Beveridge 4.0, because Beveridge wrote a third report at the end of his life where he said he thought he'd made a mistake and he had left communities and people out of his vision and out of his work, and it had been too top down. And so I took that as my starting point and wrote this manifesto saying, what would happen if instead of these very vertical kind of controlling industrial systems, we thought much more horizontally and relationally, and we included people in the design and the way that we run our public systems.
So how do you turn that kind of first-hand information into policy? For example, perhaps you could give us Ella's story and how you worked with her.
Yes, so Ella is the mother of one of a small number of families that I started to work with to build a sort of national programme called Life, which was working differently with families. And so we started off by just spending time with Ella. So we were there, you know, after dark when problems happened in the family. We met the social worker sitting alongside her. And what we saw was that, you know, at the time the government was saying that each of these families cost £250,000, but that money was just spinning in a system around Ella, and not really one penny of that money was touching Ella. And in a way, she also wasn't safe because the system felt so frightening to her. So, for example, she had one mobile phone for her small number of friends and another to manage the social, as she called them, social workers. So nobody really knew what was going on and no change was happening in her life. So at this point, we asked the, you know, hundreds of workers that circulated around each family to stand back. And we got together a group of mothers and we asked them to interview the workers to choose a team. And I remember the first person who came forward was a police officer. And so Ella said, when my son's, you know, mouthing off, what are you going to do? When he's become violent, what are you going to do? And the police officer said, oh, I don't know. I'll tackle him to the ground and then I'll ask him what you think you should do. And she said, OK, right, you're on. Because what she saw in that interaction was somebody that's going to relate to me as a human, somebody that's not going to talk according to a script and is going to kind of be part of my life and sort out problems. And what I would say from the worker point of view is that social workers, for example, really love this work because you go into public service to make change. You don't go in to do what happens now, which is 80% of your time filling out forms. And so we use technology in a very deft way to take away all of that burden of the administration and allow frontline workers to do the work that they train for, build a relationship with families, stand alongside families. And really quite significant change started to emerge quite fast. first.
It sounds as though there were a lot of sort of satellites orbiting Ella, but what was needed was somebody to really interact with her.
Yes, so there was this sort of system that just... I mean, I remember this extraordinary moment when I watched a social worker interview her son, or rather it was meant to be time with her son, but it was actually an interview, because what he needed was information for his forms, which, so he said, you know, how often have you gone to school, have you been smoking, and it wasn't the kind of conversation that could ever build a relationship of trust and change. So there is this satellite, this gyroscope that's going around that is very expensive and isn't good for our brilliant frontline workers who want to make change, or for families who want to make change. So we had to kind of undo that really and build relationships. It's all about relationships. Relationships, you know, relationships of trust, long term, making a plan, families knowing that people will be there alongside them for however long it takes, because these problems are difficult, knotty and painful, and then change begins to happen.
Well, that's a huge challenge. And to soothe you as you think of ways through it, Purcell next.
So I know that this is one of the most popular pieces on this programme, which I think is very interesting. It speaks to something inside us, a sort of God-shaped hole, if you like, and a longing for something. I mean, I find it very hard to listen to this music without crying. I think it's so powerful and emotional. And it's a huge privilege that I have this working life where I sit alongside people. I go and live in communities, stay for often quite extended periods of time. And I hear people share their stories with me, you know, in sort of real visceral honesty. We live in a very unequal country, and a lot of those stories are extremely painful. And I think I'm drawn to music like this, Dido's Lament, because it's a way of feeling those feelings and processing that hurt in a way.
Thank you.
particularly dolorous performance, I think.
Yes, I think all the troubles of the world are in that voice, in a way, yes.
Dido's Lament, When I Am Laid in Earth by Purcell, performed by Andreas Scholl and the Accademia Byzantina Orchestra, conducted by Stefano Montanari. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the social entrepreneur Hilary Cottam. I'm very fascinated to try and understand, Hilary, given the enormity of the projects you've taken on, how you actually get into the research, how you find your way into the solutions for these problems.
So I usually pick things like the family work or ageing, where I think that we've been stuck for a long time in a loop that many people have tried and had a go, and probably nothing could be worse than what's happening already. You know, it's low risk, if you like, to kind of think differently about it. And then the process starts in a very open way by going into communities, asking people if they collaborate, having very open conversations, usually using something visual as a prompt for the imagination. And from those stories, kind of listening, building, going back round again until we begin to hear. It is like a melody. I mean, in the book that I've just written, The Work We Need, you know, I've had hundreds of conversations across Britain and America with workers from all walks of life, nuclear weapon makers, carers and so on. And after a while, the themes, they were sort of the melodies that just sang out.
Another problem that you've addressed, and it's really an awful one, was the issue of loneliness and how to look after older people. You came up with an idea called Circle, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes. The most important thing in determining what happens to you in your older age is your social connections. It's like a game of Jenga. You can take everything else out, but if you're not socially connected, things start to go wrong. So we spent a lot of time with older people, you know, playing darts, bingo, gardening, whatever. And in the beginning, people told us they wanted three things. They wanted help with little things, they wanted social connection, and they said that they wanted life coaches, because, you know, we've got all of these years ahead of us, how can we use them differently? But life coaches turned out to be too in your face, nobody liked them. And that was also very interesting, because in a traditional policy making process, you'd say, oh, people told us we wanted life coaches, and you'd employ hundreds, and then you'd have a project that doesn't work, which happens so often. We had two people that were really lovely, and we said to them, look, sorry, it's not working, and, you know, they were just with us for a bit, and we carried on. And so we built Circle, which is halfway between a sort of concierge service, if you like, and a kind of social club. And people pay very small amounts of money to join, and that enables them to kind of join this rich social mix, which is activities, and also to get practical on-demand help. What's really interesting over time, we've learned, is that the social connections replace the help. So perhaps in the beginning, Circle might pick you up from a hospital appointment, but over time, what we see is that the friends you make help pick you up, and that by really facilitating a network and keeping it very open, making sure it doesn't morph to certain groups and keeping the activities very open, that people begin to flourish in really, really interesting ways. And then, of course, if you've got a membership organisation of hundreds, then you've always got somebody to run a lift, pick up the washing, change the light bulb, do a spot of gardening. We do have paid helpers as well. But basically, the network becomes very, very strong, and then the service is very, very rich. And so Circle is very strong across the northwest of England. And I'm working actually at the moment with the government in Denmark to adapt the same model.
And then you moved on to people out of work.
Yes, so that work was about people who'd been very long-term unemployed. And so what we did was we set up to begin with in a job centre in South London. So we put things outside saying the job centre isn't working. We put up a fake door inside and we said, if you give us £5, you can come through our door rather than go through the job centre door. And then we invited people back to pubs in the evenings to work out a different way of working. And what we found was that people, you know, are disconnected. The worst way to find work in a modern economy is to stand in a queue in a job centre with somebody like you who's out of work. That what you need are very diverse connections to people in work, in different forms of work. And it's most likely the longer you've been in that queue, or the less good your education, the narrower your social network. So it's about building, kind of bridging different social networks. So we basically began to host evenings in very broad themes: people who want to work with people who want to go to different places and connect people. And we found that this was an extremely powerful way of getting people back into work, partly because nobody wants to have a sort of what they think of as a dead-end job. You know, there was a wonderful man who'd kind of been in and out of prison. He was called Earl, and he said, I want a profession. And he wanted to be a professional chef. Now, there were lots of jobs of doing washing up and kind of doing the prep in the kitchen, and he wasn't prepared to take one of those jobs because he saw himself as a chef. And what we said was, why don't you take one of those jobs? We'll stay with you. You get the first experience. We'll accompany you until you become a chef. And that's what happened. Not saying, OK, we've just counted you now as somebody with a job and we'll forget about you, was very powerful. So we invented a service called Backer, which basically cost a third of any existing UK approach and was three times as successful.
A song without words next.
Oh, these Mendelssohn songs are very beautiful. And I find writing very difficult. You know, it's not something that comes naturally to me. And Mendelssohn's songs without words are what I play to sort of come into that mindset where I can begin to think, I suppose, of my own words. Perhaps not very flattering to Mendelssohn. I'm sure he doesn't want to think of himself as background music. But because it is so lyrical, but the words aren't there, it helps the words to flow. Sort of ripples, doesn't it? And then yeah. The words can come. But there's some attack in there as well, isn't there? Sort of, you know, focused attack.
András Schiff playing the Fleecy Cow from Mendelssohn's Song Without Words. Hilary Cottam, in your book, The Work We Need, you're looking at the world of work. What led you to feel you needed to examine that?
Beveridge designed the welfare state around good work. He assumed that there would be good work and that people would have education for that work. If they got unwell, there would be health services, there would be pensions. But now the whole thing is sort of turned about face. You know, we have tried for decades now, really, to kind of address deep social issues through welfare rather than thinking about what are some of those underlying causes. And a symptom of that is that the amount of money that goes on unemployment benefits, even though it's very high sort of in the media, is absolutely minuscule compared to the amount that goes on in-work benefits, which is essentially the third of British families that receive money to top up their wages because businesses are not paying people enough to live on. And I'm not saying, of course, there's nothing wrong with that. All families need that money. But what they would rather have would be good work where we can stand on our own feet and make our own decisions. So I thought, you know, really, I need to focus differently on work. And I started by going back to post-industrial areas and asking people who represent those areas, what do you think we should do? And people would put their heads in their hands and go, you know, I just don't know. So many things have been tried. And I suppose that work was an area that I thought belonged to economists, and I'm not an economist. Then I just thought, well, I've got to go and ask myself. You know, this isn't kind of good enough. So I set off with my rucksack.
You asked people to come to what you called imaginings.
Yes.
How important was that word, imagining, in setting the tone?
Really important. You know, I wanted everybody to feel that they had something to say, and we all have imagination. And also because I think that work has got so trapped in sort of very technocratic, you know, we can raise this benefit by this or lower this by that. And I wanted to think completely differently about it. One thing I know as a historian is that there are moments where work dramatically changes, and it can happen almost overnight. And I think we are in one of those moments where technology, ecology, our own sort of feelings that things aren't right are going to bring a kind of cataclysm in work. And history also shows us that if we're ready and if we've got ideas about how to shape that moment, huge gains can be made by workers. And it matters who imagines, you know, who is given the space, who is invited in to imagine. And I wanted people from all walks of life to join me in that space. I didn't know what would happen. I thought people would leave in a tea break. But actually, the opposite happened. People really welcomed it and stayed and said, when can we do more of this?
I was fascinated that you discovered that, and I understand this so well, most people want meaning to the work that they do.
Yes, to have meaning in your work is absolutely critical. And meaning means that you feel that you have skills, your work has purpose, that you understand the role of work in the world and therefore your role in the world. So one of the places that I worked was at BAE's nuclear submarine systems. And people who are building those nuclear submarines, which obviously are very controversial, feel that they are playing a really important role in the nation's defence. They feel that every ratchet they make, somebody down there is going to, you know, survive or not according to the quality of that ratchet. And also, really importantly, they're making end-to-end. So most of the team on a nuclear submarine are making that submarine for a 7-year period, which of course is very rare. You know, our work is being chopped up. You know, Marx wrote about it, but it's become more extreme since then, chopped up into ever smaller bits. So meaning is about the work itself, but it's also because work is a path through which we understand who we are and we find our own meaning, and those two are very entwined and, I think, important to say, extremely different to company values and what might be painted on the wall of the company you work at.
You also look at juggling the work-life balance, the fact that a lot of people have to care for someone.
Yes, I think until we can redesign care work, we are going to be in a really big pickle, because people find it impossible to juggle most modern work with caring roles. And we've got a story really that, you know, we're all workers and, you know, care must be fitted around the edges, what people call the juggle in my work. But actually that makes us very unhappy. It makes many people drop out of the workforce, which is something that government's very concerned about. Very small things like being able to keep your mobile phone next to you as you work can make a huge difference. I went to a factory in Baltimore, for example, where they were making houses, prefabricated houses. So they changed all the machinery so that women could do the work, but they weren't getting women employers. Now, of course, wrongly or rightly, it's still women who are the ones who are called when the child gets sick at school or the pickup hasn't happened, and women are less likely to accept work where they can't be called in any moment of emergency. So these are just very small things that could make a very big difference. And that, you know, in this century, we want to develop as full humans, and part of that is caring for each other, for our friends, our families. It's not something we can sort of keep shoving off to the side, because our societies are not working when we do that.
Music for String Quartet next, by Caroline Shaw.
Yes. You know, I heard Caroline Shaw played by the Attica Quartet at King's Place. And in my work, somebody said he introduced himself to me as a former pirate of the high seas, which is quite an opening, but he was a cod fisherman until the kind of industrial cod stocks fell. And now he's a vertical farmer of sargassums and things in the sea, which kind of restore the quality of the sea and are also, you know, very important edibles. But he said to me, you know, a good working life is one that we can sing songs about. Who has the songs, you know? And I suppose that if I had a song to sing about, I would choose this Caroline Shaw as the song of my work. I really feel it's very beautiful as a sort of tiptoeing investigation. You get in the weeds of it, and then there's a kind of pared back simplicity, which is the solution at the end in the way the music resolves itself. incredible, isn't it? Maybe I should say more, I want to make work like that. I just, you know, it's so inspiring.
What's interesting, too, is that silence draws you closer in because the ear has to concentrate even more.
It's so true. I think that's the same with the storytelling, that to make change, we need to tell stories where people go, ooh, and kind of draw in, rather than we've got a lot of loudness and maybe that doesn't make change. That's so true.
We heard Ellipse by Caroline Shaw, performed by the Attacker String Quartet. Hilary Cottam, you've also looked at the way time is measured nowadays compared to the past. Johnny, a gravedigger from Kilmarnock, had some interesting ideas about that, didn't he?
Johnny the gravedigger, he immediately took a piece of paper and he began to redesign a working life and redesign time. And he drew this incredible diagram with sort of passion projects and different times. And he was like, you know, I don't want to take my holidays in the same year. I want to do all these different things. He'd left school at 16 and he'd done many different things. And he was sort of a man who was very happy in his skin. But he had very, very radical ideas about how we now need to redesign time. And then, you know, one of the last pieces of work I did was in a boardroom in London in the finance district with consultants, and they said exactly the same. They began to draw and said, you know, we don't want to make partner, like nothing is worth kind of what we have to sacrifice in time. And there's a lot of discussion about the four-day working week, which, of course, I think is very interesting and very valuable. But people were like, oh, well, that's just a tactic. We can get to somewhere completely different.
So is working less an option?
Working less, working differently. I definitely think working less. And any business that has tried working less, we've just had a very big experiment with 50 companies ranging from Blue Chip to kind of a chippy in Britain. And any company that has tried giving their workers back time for the same pay, so it's less hours, same pay, has found that absenteeism has dropped off. Workers are more productive, profits have gone up.
And of course it has ecological benefits too.
Well, that's really important. So when we work too hard, we are very resource hungry. We eat food on the go out of non-recyclable containers. We buy things we don't really need. We get gifts for saying sorry that we didn't turn up somewhere on time. And of course in the US, where a lot of my work has happened, commutes are by car, so very heavy on the environment.
You also identified play as being an important component of work, and the fact that women play much less than most.
Yes, and I confess that play wasn't really something that I had spent much time thinking about, but it's so important that people recognise that they need this dimension, which is, you know, what music offers us in some ways, like living in a different dimension, living in a different non-commoditised part of ourselves. Mothers were organising the play for everybody else. They were organising play sessions, family, whatever it is, and then afterwards feeling exhausted. And actually research shows that this is a pattern. And often in the childbearing years, women basically stop playing. And it seems that play is a muscle. If we don't use it, we sort of forget how to use it. But I think what's important is to kind of acknowledge that this is a deep inequality. Who plays? Women don't play. People on low incomes, you know, who can't afford the basics don't play. And play is something that is important for us personally, but also important for us as a society.
You're a good example to them, because in your 50s you took up the piano, Hilary, talking about play. And I think the next piece is one that you've completely mastered.
Oh, well, no. But, you know, I have mastered some Chopin. I chose this. How can you choose Chopin? I mean, I had to take up the piano to play Chopin. And I think that this particular mazurka we're going to listen to is so both at once velvety and sinister and just extraordinary.
And it also reminds you of Peckham, what you've lived
Yeah, so I have chosen a performance by Pavel Kolesnikov, who I heard play this mazurka in the car park in Peckham, because Hannah Barry converted the top to be a place of music. And I love being in the audience. It's such a different audience. It's everybody goes. It's all ages, all races. It's just a completely different classical audience, which I think is really exciting. And then also, Pavel Kolesnikov is an extraordinary pianist, but he's happy to go there and play with the trains running by and the concrete acoustic. And, you know, I just think that's so important, you know, about getting stuck in and trying to do things differently. And I suppose in his field, he's done that. And I know that with his partner, Samson Soy, they've got this Ragged Music Festival, which again is about taking music to different audiences. So this brings two things together, really. Those performances in that place by an extraordinary pianist with music that I love.
Thank you.
I love the way Chopin has that note which just makes you sit up, that it almost shouldn't be there and yet it so much should. Mm. The Mazurka in A minor by Chopin, performed by Pavel Kolesnikov. And you now play that quite well.
No, I'm such a beginner, you know, I play very little. But I think one of the things about playing is it you begin to listen in a different way, don't you? It's like drawing and seeing in a different way. So I also value it for that.
Hilary Cottam, you've recently moved, I think, to Herefordshire. What prompted that?
Well, we're in the process, yes. My family's from Herefordshire originally, and I always wanted to live there. I'm a very keen vegetable grower, and I wanted to kind of live in a different way, I suppose. And so that's the experiment that's beginning now.
And your latest project is conducting a review of upland farming, I think.
Yeah, because I think, you know, one of the things that's going to change work fastest is not, in fact, technology, despite all the talk about AI, it's ecology. And so I have been invited by the Secretary of State at DEFRA to look at upland farming areas. These are places where there's a lot of confrontation around very scarce resources. There's obviously farmers who have farmed for many generations, very important kind of hefted flocks and ways of farming that are under threat. And, you know, if those same farmers were farming in the Amazon, we'd probably all be out on the streets trying to protect them. And at the same time, these are areas which are very important environmentally in terms of the water resources, the peat. And so there has been some sort of confrontation, and it's quite difficult to decide what to do. And so I have been asked really to go and have a look. So I'm currently spending time very wonderfully walking with farmers of all different descriptions, running imagination sessions in pubs with teachers and bakers, and also meeting different environmental groups. And we're at the beginning of the exploration. But I think rural work is so important, and something really that, you know, we're a very urban society and we need to think again about rural work.
And maybe it prompted your final piece.
Oh, yes, I think so, because this piece really is about the sounds of nature. So this is a kind of movement in work and a movement to my own home. I mean, obviously, I now wake up somewhere which is just enormously loud with birdsong. But it's also a sort of return to my roots in the sense of my mother singing folk songs and her beautiful voice, and this being a sort of in that tradition, I suppose.
Well, nice to have begun with music that was prompted by your father and to end with music prompted by your mother. It's The Cuckoo by Benjamin Britten, but it's in a performance by Cosmo Sheldrake. What made you choose this one?
Well, I recently heard this work, and I'm very interested in the work of both the Sheldrakes. I mean, Cosmo's work with kind of music and nature, and Merlin's work obviously kind of with fungal technology, which I think, you know, in my work is a very important metaphor that we build things, not everything works, but it's like a very, you know, mycelium network that things keep popping up. And I think that that's what's happening to us now, that the kind of forces of change, if we can allow those stories of hope and difference to be heard, are very powerful.
Well, it only remains for me to thank you very much indeed, Hilary Cottam.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you do
in April? I open my bill in May. I sing night and day in June. I change my tune in July. Far off I fly in August away.
What do you do
in April? I open my bill in May. I sing night and day in June. I change my tune in July. Far off I fly in August away.
Do you do
in April? I open my bill in May. I sing night and day in June.
I change my tune in July. Far off I fly in August away. I
Cuckoo by Benjamin Britten and performed by Cosmo Sheldrake, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the writer, innovator and social entrepreneur Hilary Cottam. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael's going to be talking to the singer-songwriter Suzanne Vega. And next on Radio 3, Music Map is heading on a journey to Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf.
BBC Radio 3. The home of classical music.
Just remember the five-part harmony and my auntie singing bass. And I just thought that was the most amazing thing I'd ever heard.
I've always loved choral singing. And to hear this, and it's got such a feeling of Vienna.
The intensity of the playing, the depth of emotion.
I absolutely love it.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
I don't think I could do what I do without music. It's such a comfort to me.
Listen on your radio, on BBC Sounds, and ask your smart speaker to play Radio 3.
And at 1:30, it's time for this week's edition of Music Map with Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, a chance to get to know a single piece of classical music through myriad sonic connections. In each show, we wend our way towards a musical destination through a landscape of other works that have some kind of relationship to it. And today, we're exploring a much-loved piece of musical storytelling for children, Peter and the Wolf. Peter and the Wolf tells the tale of a young boy in the Russian countryside who heads out against the advice of his grandfather and, along with his friends, the duck, the bird and the cat, gets into a very sticky situation with a wolf and some hunters. In an hour's time here on Radio 3, we'll be able to sit back and experience the whole story of that Russian folktale, expertly guided by none other than David Bowie as narrator. And characterised with inventive orchestration and musical cunning by the Russian composer Sergei Prokofiev. It's one of the pieces he's best known for, along with this. We'll be right back.